Hello everyone and welcome to the Kiseki Cast. I'm your host Tyler, and joining me is my co-host Josh.
Hey guys.
And once again, we welcome back our special guest, the Kiseki Nut.
Hey guys, thanks for having me back again.
We are here to talk about the middle part of Cold Steel 2 today, but first, I wanted to check in with Josh because Josh has been working on getting our podcasts up on YouTube.
Yeah. So actually, I didn't tell you guys about them, huh? So basically, I don't know, one day I just woke up and feeling like maybe I should upload our stuff on YouTube. And then I powered through like 20-something thumbnails. Worked it on a single day. And I just have to for context, okay, you guys, but like my MacBook is severely slow in like rendering videos just on iMovies alone, so it'll take a while for our stuff to go online because I have to render a lot of videos, but I promise you guys, our stuff will be on YouTube soon enough.
Yeah, that's awesome. That was something that a couple people have suggested in the past, and I just don't have the capacity to make that, so thanks for putting those together, Josh.
No problem.
So the part that we kind of left off at is right after we collected all of our students, all of Class 7 back together again. And after that, we kind of all head to Amir, and they spend some time at the, is it the Phoenix Wings? Is that what it's called? The Phoenix Wings Hot Springs?
I think so.
I believe so, yeah.
And that's where...
Here's the thing, actually, that I'm not actually sure if they shared a name with how they call the, what's the ship called again?
The Crimson Wings.
Crimson Wings. Oh, yeah. Wings. Like, are they related or something? I don't know.
It could be that, like, you know, there's a lot of similar naming conventions in Trails, so it could be some shared origins there.
Yeah.
But I think this is where you have the point that we mentioned before where you pick your the favorite entrance of character. And is it just me, or is Reen way too awkward with like almost anyone when you pick them and have the scene where they chat in the hot springs? It seems, I mean, it's a little bit especially so with any of the girls, but it seems like almost, is this like an anime trope where it's just super awkward?
Well, I mean, you could say the Trails is a harem, and it's pretty much like a trope on anime already, so
yeah, I'd have to agree with that as well. I didn't actually go with any of the girl characters. I've decided to go with Gaius, I think, on my first playthrough, and then Eusis on my second. Maybe I just couldn't handle the trope more than anything else, but it was alright. It was fine. It was just interesting that obviously you had that massive list and then putting it on the player to decide who their favourite entrance is. It was quite a difficult choice, I will say that.
I'm boring and I've only ever picked Alisa whenever I play that game.
You mean you guys didn't save beforehand and then reload like 15 times?
No. Actually, I didn't even know that that's a trick to like get those trophies.
I discovered that by accident because I wanted to see some of the scenes, so I was saving right beforehand and then reloading. And I didn't know that you could do it that way until, I guess, at the very end of Cold Steel 1, where, you know, it gave me a trophy, and I'm like, oh, cool, I guess, you know, I got that one. And then I reloaded, and it gave me a second one. I'm like, oh, okay, so this is how people do it so fast. So it's at this point, just about to this point, that Class 7 decides to be, like, a third faction within the currently ongoing Civil War. They kind of decided a little bit earlier, but they decide not to side with either the Reformist or the Noble faction. And this is kind of one of the things that ends up being really contentious among fans because, especially on the surface, they, you know, they don't take up arms with one or the other side, but I think it's pretty obvious that they're at least standing against the current, like, status quo from which the nobles are benefiting. And when you pair that with the fact that they end up flying around the country at their own will in, like, the most prestigious airship in Erebonia, it's not exactly subtle. And so I think people really took notice of that. TKN, in one of your more recent videos, you pointed out that Class 7 stance is more about trying to keep non-combatants safe, which I can definitely get behind. But would you say that Class 7 shows a tendency to be more friendly to the Reformist faction? I mean, they end up doing brace requests for Olivert, and they use Elliot's dad's army base as an HQ one or two times. You know, it seems like they're maybe not taking full opposition stance to the nobles, but they're definitely more friendly with the Reformers faction. Would you say that?
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I don't think they ever fight. Well, you say fight. I don't think they ever do anything to the benefit of the Noble Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Class 7 is just there, like I said in that video, to be the party that keeps other innocent parties out of it. So they don't really get involved in terms of fighting per se. I think the only especially when they're in the Nord Highlands, they see that the nomad Gaius's family and his the other nomads are being pushed out of the Nord Highlands, and they obviously don't want that to happen. And then it just so happens that they're always going to be helping the Imperial side. I think as well the fact that Elliot's dad is an Imperial general. They have Marcius's father, who is governor of Heimdall. So it just so happens that a lot of the Reformist faction happen to be related to Class 7 in some way, so I think that might lend to it. I think that Class 7's role as the third faction, though, is handled mostly correctly, because the Noble faction isn't really the most upstanding group in Cold Steel 2,
mm-hmm.
At least in terms of the head honchos, which are Duke Alborea and I can't remember his name, and it's just gone off the top of my head.
Duke Cayenne,
yeah. They're not exactly the most upstanding ones, so I guess in a way their prerogative kind of leans them more towards the Reformist faction out of a sense of duty more than anything else. I'm sure that if the Imperial faction were doing heinous acts, they would also get involved against them as well, but it just so happens that it's only the Noble Alliance who are doing it in Cold Steel 2, it seems.
Yeah, that's a good point. Josh, do you think that maybe this is a little bit of a contentious issue with fans because you have to dig a little bit deeper than just, like, surface-level stuff to really see what the third faction kind of stood for?
From my experience, actually, I didn't really feel like, you know, that Class 7 was the third faction, because there were so many times where you were trying to aid the Reformist faction,
mm-hmm.
and then I think there was only one time where you had the Noble Alliance on your side when they were trying to enforce Duke Alborea, I think. And so, yeah, when that was just me playing for the first time, by the way, but going through Cold Steel 2 multiple times now, I actually figured out how Class 7 established itself as a neutral faction, because I think I recall somewhere that what are you called, the squads division, military division? That's what they're called, right?
Yeah, armored divisions.
Yeah, the armor division that Class 7 mostly helped in the Civil War was neutral, or not exactly leaning towards the Reformist faction. So I think like you said, Tyler, I think you have to go a little, you have to dig a little deeper to find out, you know, Class 7 stance and all that.
Yeah, I think TKN, your video, did a really good job of pointing out what they were really trying to get at, because, you know, they definitely don't try to get involved that much, but, you know, if you're just kind of going through and not really analyzing it that much, it does really seem like they're just kind of going through without really a whole lot of thought, maybe, or a whole lot of direction. But, you know, you did bring up, I really appreciated that you did that, because I think that's something that a lot of people missed.
Yeah, well, I can't take complete credit for it at all, because I missed it the first time as well.
Mm-hmm.
On my first playthrough, it was ultimately why Cold Steel 2 was my least favorite game at that point in time, because I initially thought to myself, why are Class 7 not on the front lines? Why are they not doing anything else? Why is all the fighting in the West? And I think when I looked at the Civil War, I wanted it to be more, because obviously it was built up from Cold Steel 1. We obviously knew it from the Crossbell arc as well, even though I hadn't played it at that point. The Civil War was meant to be a pretty big deal, especially when you consider how bloody it was meant to be as well. And I felt that on my first playthrough, Class 7 didn't have the impact that I wanted them to. But then you have to look below the surface. It's never been their role to be on the front lines. It was never their role to assist the Noble Alliance or assist the Reformist faction, like, regardless of what they actually end up doing. It was always their role to assist the Innocents, and that's ultimately where they get involved in Act 2, where, you know, they save Fiona and all this kind of stuff, because the Noble Alliance use her as a prisoner of war, basically, to gain an upper hand, all that kind of stuff. So, no, it flew over my head the first time, and I'm not sure if it's just me being, if it was me being dense at the time, or if it just wasn't told well enough, because there's a lot going on in Cold Steel 2, especially when you're jumping from point to point across all of Eastern Erebonia, and that's why, well, personally, I'm glad that I played it again. I probably would have to play it a third time to fully grasp it. I'm sure there's some things that flew over my head the first time.
I don't.
And also, I think that we're also kind of forgetting that ultimately the Class 7's role was only just to take back the school, wasn't it?
Hmm.
That's true. That was like the only real goal that they had themselves. But I don't think that you were being dense, because a lot of the criticism that you do see of Cold Steel 2 seems to be like, you know, they don't show the Civil War in the West. And as you said, that wasn't really what Class 7's, you know, they weren't a warrior class. That wasn't what the formation of the class was supposed to be for.
Oh, you can definitely say that again.
And that, you know, if it was a different type of game, a different type of gameplay, you might have seen that. They might have taken them to the West, but it seems kind of odd to me to, like, fight an entire civil war in, like, a turn-based format.
Yeah. I mean, if it took, say, a Valkyria Chronicles kind of look, then maybe it would make more sense, like, from a gameplay standpoint, like you say as well. It wouldn't really work on a turn-based style, would it? But I think also it's kind of like a coming of age for Class 7, because they're ultimately given the Crimson Wings by Olivert. Like Reen and Class 7 all say, you know, we're not going to be able to do much. We're just students, but we can at least act as that third faction. And then Olivert's like, okay, cool. You've given me the answer I want. Have the Crimson Wings. The whole of Eastern Erebonia is under your jurisdiction. Do with it what you can to end the war in your own way, and we're going to go to the West. So the responsibility was kind of split at that point between, obviously, Class 7, who had seen Eastern Erebonia themselves, and obviously in some cases some of them had gone to Western Erebonia as well, but we never really saw that in Cold Steel 1. But it's kind of like that shifting of responsibility, like, you know, this is your coming of age, show us what you can do, in a way. I think Olivert's kind of putting them on stage, so to speak.
So do you think that maybe because it was kind of split duties, with Olivert going to the West and Class 7 staying in the East, that's part of what helped the eastern part of the Civil War not be as bad?
I think inherently it was going to be worse on the West, because obviously you had, on the Western side, the Noble Alliance was obviously based in, well, they had Heimdall, but they also had Lemaire province. They had two of the strongest generals as head of the Sutherland army and the Lemaire army at that point as well, in Aurelia and Wallace Bardius. So in terms of the war over there, I think it was always going to be a bit more concentrated on that front because of the power that each side had in that area. I think on the eastern side, obviously, you still had it as well with the 4th Armored Division, and you had the Noble Alliance with their Soldats. But I think that in terms of the fact that Class 7 had the Crimson Wings as well, it definitely assisted in making the war less impactful on the eastern side. But I just personally think there is that inherent side to it as well, that the west was always going to be more bloody just because of its location, its proximity to some of the bigger powerhouses between the two factions as well. And they were inevitably going to clash and cause more collateral damage as they fought each other.
Let's talk about the Pantagruel a bit, and when we spend time aboard the ship of the Noble Alliance. So, Josh, what's your thoughts on this collection of antagonists that we get on this ship?
I actually thought it was pretty weird when the first time I played it. Like, I don't think I've ever played a game where you have to get to know the villains, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you like the fact that the only returning enforcer that we get, oh no, it wasn't a returning enforcer for you because you hadn't played Sky, was it? Was the only one we get that we've seen before is Blue Blanc. And I was personally a little bit disappointed because he was like one of my lesser favorites because he's just kind of annoying. You know, I don't like Walter because he's just a huge jerk. And he's kind of like, I think Walter's a better villain because we just hate him because he's just such a bad guy. But Blue Blanc, people don't like him because he's, like, annoying. And I don't think that necessarily makes him a great villain.
I mean, I guess he just has to be there because he's over the top. Well, I mean, I don't think we have any other, like, enforcers that would come back anyway. Like, Ren and Joshua are out. And who's the other one again?
Luciola.
Luciola's... I don't know, dead or something.
Well, people were thinking, spoilers for Crossbell arc here, but people were thinking she is in Zero.
Mm-hmm.
The fortune teller.
The fortune teller, yeah. So she's hanging out over there.
Well, I mean, I guess Blue Blanc is a better rival of sorts for Oliver because...
For Oliver?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess I can see that.
Yeah, I think it makes sense to have... To have Blue Blanc there, especially with his rivalry with Oliver.
Shirley can't be there as well, right? Because she's in Crossbow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, this is one of the first times that we get to meet up with Crow again since Cold Steel 1. And I do have to say that fish burgers sound horrendous to me.
You've never had those before?
Yeah, have you never had a McFish or anything like that from McDonald's?
It's like just an enormous fish stick. And like fish sticks are okay, but like I don't want this giant fish patty. Like that just doesn't seem good to me.
I think it sounds pretty good actually.
I've had a fish fillet burger once.
I don't mind like some fish and chips, but I don't know. It just, when they said, like, have this fish burger, I remember being like, ugh. Well, so, what did you guys think of the big info dump we get here from Crow? Because I feel like we're only given so much backstory and history on him. We didn't get any before. And part of that was so that we could, you know, they could reveal that he was going to betray the class and that he was... see and everything.
Honestly, for me, I wish it was revealed like on the first game. You're right. We really didn't get anything from Crow on the first game at all.
Yeah, it was all just given to us like here. And I don't know, in my opinion, it doesn't feel super authentic because it just feels like they're trying to give you this like 2-minute sob story so that you can suddenly feel something about him. I mean, if you liked him in the first place, you know, Josh, you really liked him, and then he betrayed our side. And how did you feel?
No, I was pissed at Crow actually when he betrayed us. And when I heard the, when I heard his story, I'm like, oh my gosh, no, you're going to make me like him again.
Okay, I guess I forgot
that part. I do not condone terrorism, by the way.
TKN, did this make you feel anything, like, sympathetic for Crow at all?
Yeah, it did, actually. I actually liked this part quite a bit. Like, obviously, at the end of Cold Steel 1, you know I didn't like Crow very much. Mm-hmm. After his betrayal, I was like, I felt betrayed, which obviously is what it's meant to make you feel like.
Right.
And I think Cold Steel 1 had to strike a balance. You couldn't give too much backstory on Crow, because obviously he is the main antagonist, he is the big twist. And I think most of us here said it caught us all off guard, didn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, none of us knew it was Crow. And if you gave too much backstory to Crow, you risked that identity being figured out too early, and you would miss out on that awesome reveal at the end. Mm-hmm. And it is an awesome reveal. It's one of my favorite reveals in the whole series. So then you've got him as this enemy, but you need to then give the back. That's when you need to give the backstory. That's when you need to figure out more about Crow and why he does this and what his motivations are. And it sets him up really well as an anti-hero, in my opinion, because obviously he says himself, it's your typical run-of-the-mill sob story. Literally, there's nothing special about it. Here it is. He says it to Reen. My grandfather was outsmarted by Osborn. From that point, I just wanted to kill him. And you can see that Crow is... What I love about Crow as compared to V and S is that V and S have basically given up. They've basically gone, well, we've killed Osborn, we don't need to do anything now. We've got no other reason to live. Crow's basically saying that he knew what killing Osborn was going to do. He knew that killing Osborn was going to set off a civil war. And he feels... Yeah, and now it's his responsibility to clean it up as quickly as he can, and he feels that joining up with the Noble Alliance, he can do that. It may not be the best thing in the world, but that was his motivation, that was his goal. Kill Osborn, make sure that the war ends as quickly as possible with his Azure Knight. There you go. And I like it. I really do like it. It shows that he's still a sympathetic character, but he's not afraid to go after what he wants. And now that ultimately, even though his goal is completed, so to speak, he wants to make sure that innocent people have as little suffering as possible during the course of this war.
All right, so that actually puts a lot of it into a different perspective for me, because, you know, when I got to this point, I just didn't really... I didn't really care about Crow that much before, and this felt like... It didn't feel like they were giving him the same, they weren't humanizing him in the same way that we got in Sky, because they were just giving us all of this all at once. You know, we got Joshua in bits and pieces over 2 games, we got Ren over 3 games, even Agate wasn't just, like, crushed into just the attack on Ravenous Village. We get a little bit here and there spread out through FC and SC. And honestly, he's like a minor supporting character when you think about how important other characters are. So, because Crow is such a bigger part of the Cold Steel arc than what Agate was in Sky, it seemed like we should have gotten a little bit more. But you are right that if they gave us too much more, then it wouldn't have been as much of a reveal in Cold Steel 1. Maybe I'm just conflicted on how I feel about Crow.
Yeah, it's a tough balance. I personally wish there was a bit more on Crow, but I think Falcom did as best as they could in Cold Steel 1. They did just enough that you would, you know, feel something for him, but also just enough that you would never suspect him either. I think it was done really well in Cold Steel 1, and then obviously Cold Steel 2, like I say, that's the point where you have to start giving him the backstory. That's where you have to start giving him the motivation, and that was welcome. I enjoyed it, and I found myself enjoying his character a lot more after that point on the Pantagruel. Not even just on the Pantagruel, but also before that as well, where he beats you into the ground for the second time. So he definitely went up my personal rankings after that point.
Yeah, now that you mention it, TK, and I just had a thought about this because I just continued playing Cold Steel 3 again, literally just a few hours ago, And I thought that, you know, that if they gave too much on Crow, because he, when Crow was, like, talking about Jurai and stuff like, you know, the annexation on Cold Steel 1, he wasn't really, you know, giving, like, a side, his side of, you know, what he wants. It, like, he, it gave me, an impression that he was neutral about it, like, as opposed to, you know, like, Yuna, where she was so negative about it because she loves Crossbow so much that... If you, you know, gave Crow Yuna's role, you would think that Crow would, you know, betray you or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he goes to Jurai, doesn't he? He goes to Jurai with some members of Class 7, and he's pretty, yeah, like you say, he's pretty nonchalant about it. He's just like, it's a special economic zone on the northwestern side of Erebonia. That's about it. And it was annexed, like, so-and-so years ago, 3-5 years ago, whatever it was. And that's it. And you're none the wiser. And I think it's really good. I really do think that is good. Because like you say, if he was like Yuna, you'd immediately think, well, okay, cool. You've got some sort of motive there.
Now, what do you guys think of McBurn? Because I have to say that I don't really like his name, even though it's kind of funny. like, it's like, come on. You're going to give the guy a name like that? I don't know if you've...
I hope it's just a title.
I don't know if you've seen it, but a couple of years ago, I made this really low-quality meme of a picture of McBurn with a very poorly photoshopped McDonald's visor on his head. And it makes the rounds occasionally, so if you ever see that, that was me. That was my handiwork, even though it's super dumb, it's super bad, but...
That's brilliant. I've got to keep an eye out for that.
I can say one good thing about McBurnin, it's his voice on both English and Japanese. It's mm-hmm. very good.
Yeah, I do have to agree that it's a very good voice actor. And I do like that he's a strong opponent, you know, like when you have to be prepared when you go into battles with him.
Oh yeah, they hype that battles very much.
Yeah, definitely.
He just seems like, I don't know, how do I put it, like...
Super, over the top.
Super anime.
Yeah. Hmm.
Which, I don't know if that's, you know, obviously it's what Trails is, but it's... The first time I got to this part, and I was just like, who is this guy?
Oh, I like his hair, too.
Yeah. I'm not so sure about his design, if I'm honest. I like what, you know, the idea that he is a really strong character, that's one thing, but... In Cold Steel 2, at least, I didn't like McBurn, like, much, because obviously he's just looking for a strong opponent, and I've always been a person who's not into that. Like, I don't like Shirley, I don't like Walter, I don't like McBurn. Thankfully, in the second half, he gets more, and I'm not going to say more than that, but he does get more, and he's become one of the most intriguing characters in the series for me now.
Mm.
But in terms, he gives you some hints and stuff like that. He's like, oh, you know, you're a half-breed or something along those lines, or you're mixed, I think he says. and then Reen's just like, oh, I'm mixed, what are you? It's like, all of me, or something along those lines. He's oddly intimidating, despite his look. I mean, if I saw this guy in the street, I would just be thinking, like, this is the biggest weirdo I think I've ever seen in my life, but he's oddly intimidating. It's good. I will say that, and I have a much deeper appreciation for him now, especially after finishing the Cold Steel arc. But in terms of the obstacle he represents, yeah, I like it. I like having those strong characters there that you just need to overcome, and there's no doubt he's the hardest battle in that game.
Do you guys think he does the Naruto run?
Like,
does he run?
I don't.
Does he run in the game?
I think he means just like, would he?
Yeah, would he do the Naruto
run? What, running into Area 51 or something along those lines? Yeah, I think he would, to be honest. I think he'd have the cape just streaming behind him and everything. He'd have the ninjutsu as well. The mirror images.
Now, you brought up his design, and something that I've been meaning to say about just Cold Steel design in general is, it's not that. It's actually something to do with the clothing that they have. So... I don't know if it's something that Falcom just does because maybe it's a really easy programming thing, like something that they can make easily on characters and swap left and right. But everyone has, like, jackets. Like, almost,
it must be an Erebonia thing.
Yeah, it could just be like in Erebonia, everyone wears jackets because everyone has jackets, and it starts early because, you know, Olivier has a jacket all the way back in Sky, but once you get into Crossbell, like, or not into Cross, once you get into Erebonia, everyone has jackets.
Isn't it probably due to the location? Like, I think, I don't know. Like, I would assume that Erebonia is a naturally cold country.
Well, parts of it for sure, but I just meant, like, you know, they all look like, how do I put it? Like, it looks like a style choice. Like, it's like, yeah, everyone has a jacket.
Yeah, I get what you mean. I mean, even Estelle has a jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. I personally think that, you know, a jacket is just more appealing to look at, I guess. I think if you looked at people in a white t-shirt and shorts consistently, I think you'd get possibly a bit bored. I think you could probably do a lot more with a jacket, and, you know, when they're flowing around that anime trope and stuff like that, and they're flowing around and they're beating each other with their OP abilities and stuff like that, it's I guess it just looks a bit cooler. I don't mind the coats too much. I just think that McBurn looks a bit stupid. That's just my personal preference, though.
What I appreciate about the characters designing Trails is they don't overdo it with the belts and zippers, at least.
Yeah.
I like the jackets. I didn't mean to say that I didn't or something like that. Because, you know, I think it's easier to give everyone, like, a really unique jacket than maybe something else. But it's just something that I noticed. And one thing that also, but one thing I do like about McBurn's design is he's got that, like, a third of the way rolled up sleeves, you know, like the cool guy roll up sleeves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I'm trying to picture his design again now. I might have to search him up and just have a look. Because he's also got the library glasses as well, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he probably doesn't even need that.
Well, he doesn't use them when he goes into Mega Mode.
No, he doesn't, does he? He just gets his yellow eyes and that's it. So he's obviously using it just to show off a little bit.
Yeah, he's also showing a little skin, you know, for the ladies.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So look. Yeah, I'm having a look at him here. It's like, he literally reminds me of somewhat like someone who you would see at the age of 16 or something like that. Or like, you know, if it was, say, like my sister would go and watch and they would claim to be metal or something like that.
Oh my god.
It kind of reminds me of that. Like,
he's a scene kid.
A scene kid, yeah. It's just, I don't
know.
Oh
my gosh, McBurn. McBurn the scene kid.
It's not
kid.
A face, Mom. It's who I am.
Yeah, and especially, and he's got the stage name as well, McBurn. So, oh dear.
We've discovered the truth.
That is the truth. Falcon, make it happen, yeah? Make it happen.
So, what do you guys think about Duvali? She's the... I remembered her name because you do fight her in Aonokiseki, so I was actually really excited to see some continuity there. And it's an interesting kind of rivalry she has with Laura, because Laura doesn't know who the heck she is, really. And it seems like... It almost seems like Duvali, like, looks up to Laura, even though she, like, everything she says kind of goes against that. I kind of think of her as, she's, like, almost a good guy. Like, she has this honor and loyalty, and she has, like, those are good traits. They just seem to be, like, you know, they're on the opposing side right now.
I love Doofily. I think she's, compared to everyone else who seems to be part of Ouroboros, she's, like, a dork, and I love it. Because obviously she's always throwing these temper tantrums. She's kind of like the comedy sketch. You have the straight guy and the idiot,
mm-hmm.
and Duvali's kind of the idiot. And
wait. So are you saying that she's like Sokka from Avatar: The Last Airbender?
Yeah, something like that. I think she kind of takes.
Oh my god!
And I really do like it, but. Also, what's so good about her is that she also can get serious when she really wants to. I think this is in Act 2 as well, like near the end of Act 2, and McBurn just disappears. He's just like, you know what? I don't want to fight. I'm bored. I'll just leave you to it. And Duvalie's obviously throwing a temper tantrum, and she gets so miffed that I think she turns it on at that point and shows what she's really capable of. Because in the first act, you can actually beat her. I think you can beat her, but you can't beat McBurn. And it shows her potentially being weaker than the other members of Ouroboros. But then, obviously, in that fight, you see what she's really capable of, and you realise, yeah, she may be a dork, but she's still pretty damn powerful.
What did you think of meeting the Imperial Liberation Front, the remaining members? I can't really say that I really cared very much about Vulcan or Scarlet here. It was just another thing to do.
Well, it looks like Scarlet's going to be in Hajimari anyway, so it looks like her story's not done so soon yet.
No, that's kind of interesting.
I don't really have anything to say about them, though.
It's kind of interesting that they are going to continue her story, because it didn't really even seem like that big of a story to me. Like, did I miss something, or maybe it just didn't stand out to me?
I think it's just her history with the church more than anything else, because obviously she was training to be a squire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because the church is going to be taking a much more prominent role, like, as we go further into the series, which a lot of people are speculating on anyway, because the church is, well, the church. I think that having Scarlet there is pretty important. And maybe you'll probably find out a little bit more about her past as well, because I think she said she came from a relatively wealthy family, like a wealthy farmer's family or something along those lines. So something unspectacular. But I would like to see more of her. I'd like to see, you know, more of her background personally. I think she's got a more to her than Vulcan did, at least.
That's a good point. Since she does have that history with the church, and by the way, I love the Templar swords. That's what they're called, right? Those are pretty sweet. I always liked that when the one that Reese has in the third.
Yeah.
We already talked about Altina a little bit in the first episode, so let's go to so Princess Alphen is the guest of honor on the Pantagruel that Reen busts her out, and they end up escaping onto the deck of the ship, which is where we have our first real all-star team gathering, I guess you could say, because the Courageous shows up, and you've got just, you know, the heaviest hitters on both sides. Josh, were you disappointed that there was no fight here?
Yeah, actually. Like, I mean, we did get, you know, a Crow and Reen fight, but, I mean, that's just, like, a sampler, I think. Like, it would be so awesome to finally get, you know, like, an all-star battle royale or some sort. But, I mean, it's probably just because it's in the middle of the game that they did not try to do that. But, I mean, it was exciting, the escape scene, but, like, come on, let's pick it up a notch, please.
Yeah, I was really, you know, it really builds you up to expect a fight here, and then they all just kind of, like, they're even like, oh, yeah, I guess it would be a tie, so let's not fight. Which is, it's so weird to me. It felt like a false climax.
I don't know, I think it was setting the stage. It's showing the rivalry between Crow and Reen. And I think that was what was meant to be the real takeaway from the ending of the Pantagruel, you know, that Crow is still miles ahead of Reen. But it's setting up that fight, and it's also setting up all of the other fights that are going to be taking place as you go further into the game as well. I mean, it would have been nice, I guess, to have a fight there, like an all-out battle, but like Josh says, you know, it's the middle of the game. They had plenty of time to just move it on till later on, which they kind of do. They don't have them all together at, say, one point, but they have those fights taking place eventually, so yeah, I was okay with it.
Plus the engine.
Well, I do have to say this, though, like, watching Japanese trailers for Colosseal 4, I just know that something along those lines will happen eventually, so I can't wait for that to happen in Colosseal 4.
Well, it seems like it has to, right? It's the last game. You gotta have some big number.
Yeah, I won't say anything.
So, now we start into Act 2, and this is when you actually do get control of the Courageous. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but here's a question to both you guys. Is it irresponsible to give a bunch of school children control over the most famous and fastest ship in Erebonia?
TKN, do you want to go first?
Well, I mean, you've got Toa. You've got Toa, who can really
okay.
do anything.
Yeah,
so.
That's true.
She's still, like, 18, though, right?
I think she's, like, yeah, like, 18 or 19 at that point. But, I mean, it's Toa. She's, like, she can literally do anything. And I'm not saying that to just be spiteful or anything towards Toa. Like, Toa can literally do anything. She's...
Yeah, she could even run the country.
Yeah, she can. She shows it. And, you know, obviously she's dragged to the West Sumeria Trade Conference because of how good she is. Everyone's saying, like, oh, we want to try and bring her, you know, all these different graduate programs are opening up to her to bring her in. So, no, I don't think that's... I don't think it's irresponsible. I think it's kind of like testing the mettle of Class 7. I think we talked about this before, that giving them the Courageous was kind of Olivert's way of, like, basically saying to them, you know, show me what you got. Show me what you've got. Grow into the wings of the winds of change, or something along those lines. So, no, I think it's cool, and I mean, Oliver probably doesn't really care too much in the grand scheme of things. Maybe he could just get another one. Who knows? Maybe he has got another one.
He's got another one.
Yeah, I mean, come on, he's a pretty rich boy, but like, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I think this is like my least favorite part of the game, but. It also features one of my favorite parts of the game, which is weird, where you go around, you know, collecting NPC students to, like, you know, be your merchants or whatever. Like, I thought that was a good, like, thing that Falcrum did, you know, because you spend so many times talking to them in the school. Like, it's just interesting to see where and what happens to them during the Civil War. Like, I thought that was a pretty cool idea for them to do.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. I have to agree with that. I think who was the one who got on my nerves a little bit though? I think it was Beryl, because every time you find her, she's like, "No, I'm not coming with you yet. I'll come with you a bit later on." But most of them, yeah, you obviously find out what they've been doing. You do a little quest for them, and they come aboard the Courageous. I like that aspect of it definitely. And I have to agree with you though that most of that part. It didn't really sit well with me at first, because obviously you're jumping around from point to point, and especially if you're doing these fetch quests. I think there's one where Marcius's friend, possibly significant other, loses her brother or something like that, and they're like, "Oh,
what? Yeah, yeah." You go, like, around the entire country.
That's it, yeah. And there's like, and their reasoning was like, "Oh, I had the map the wrong way around." So he ended up in the north and she ended up in the south or something along those lines. Like, okay, that's good reasoning. Good reasoning there. But I didn't mind it too much. I think the thing that annoyed me the most in this act were the trial chests, especially in the spirit shrines.
Yeah.
Like, in the spirit shrines, because, like, obviously you don't know where, you don't know what they are. And they normally have a cluster of trial chests, about three of them, in each spirit shrine, and then when you get to them, obviously you don't know what characters you're going to have to use, so you have to go all the way back out to bring them all the way back in, and then you figured out, oh wait, that one needed the same character I just got rid of, so I need to go back to bring them back again. So it's just, oh, that drove me insane. That was the only thing I didn't like about it.
Yeah, I forgot about the trial chest.
Yeah, I have to say that this part is my lesser favorite part of the game as well. I mean, you know, it starts out and I just don't care that Angelica shows up. I don't really care that Vulcan died. I don't really care that Reen saves Scarlet. I personally don't really like dungeons. I'm starting to appreciate them more as I play Trails. But I've never really liked that part. That's never been something I really liked in RPGs. I was more interested in the story or the characters or maybe the turn-based combat, but not so much the actual, like, dungeon exploring. And so that was, like, a slog to me. That was just, like, really, it felt like a chore to get through. So that was not easy going.
Nah, look. I can't believe how much I actually forgot about Act 2. I completely forgot, on my second playthrough, I completely forgot about the incident with Angelica, where she fights her dad, and I forgot about Fiona being kidnapped as well. So they obviously didn't really mean much to me. The only thing I remembered were Keldic and Duke Alborea. So I don't know why I forgot them. Like, they seemed like fairly memorable moments, but maybe I just didn't care at that point. Maybe I just didn't really care too much because of the spirit shrines, and they drove me insane. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Same. Actually, one more thing that stood out to me on Act 2 was the Ruhr chapter when Elisa's mom, like, you know, beat whoever that one was trying to take control of corporation.
Oh yeah, Gerhardt, and she's just like, off screen, like, turn the screen black, I'm gonna beat the head off this guy. Oh dear, I love it.
So
something hold on, Tyler, but something you brought up, TKN, about Beryl being all mysterious, like, do you guys even remember if she shows up in Cold Steel 3? Because she's too mysterious to not show up ever again.
I don't think she does show up in Cold Steel 3, but
she doesn't.
Something's up with her, for sure.
Yeah, I feel like she has a very important role. Like, I feel like she has an important role in general for the future of the series. I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with her, if I'm honest.
She's a grandmaster.
She could be.
Yeah, I actually really, I'm glad that you said that, because I had forgotten since TKN mentioned her, but that she was one that I was like, what the heck is she doing out here? This is suspicious.
Yeah, she's kind of like tripping out, isn't she? She goes to all of the spirit paths like, oh, I feel the spiritual energy, but I can't go with you yet. I need to go to the other ones. And then you find her at all of the different areas. It's just, yeah, she's a strange one.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure Emma even said that she's not a witch. And she doesn't even know what her deal is.
Nah.
So when we retake Trista, at first, you know, you're expecting like a big fight, and then you go there and...
Sorry, before we talk about taking, you know, Trista back, how did you guys think of Towa being playable?
I liked it. I told you ahead of time, because you really wanted to play as her. I think that's the only spoiler I gave you for Cold Steel 2. I was like, just so you know, you will be able to play as Towa at some point.
Honestly, I don't remember much about using Towa. I know, obviously, you use her when you drop in on Fours. And I can't remember, is she locked into your team at that point?
Can
you switch her out or put her on the bench? I can't remember.
She's required, I think.
She's required. I honestly cannot remember much about using her, if I'm honest. I like that she was there to be used, and she's... Especially the bonding events where she's like trying to use her orbital gun or whatever it is and trying to get stronger, but I honestly don't remember using her that much, if I'm honest. Maybe just my characters were a bit too powerful at that point and she didn't get a chance to shine, but it's cool. It's cool that you got to use her, there's no doubt about that. I just wish that I could have used her a little bit more. Maybe.
Yeah, she's not particularly powerful. She does have that one special move where she can like weaken the opponent. Nice.
Yeah, she she has a unique ability. She has a unique debuff, doesn't she? That's only specific to her.
Queen.
Yeah, I kind of wish that we could use her more often, because like we don't get to use her at all in Cold Steel 3, right? And she, we'll get into it later, but you know, her and Reen feel like a lot closer in Cold Steel 3, and so I was a little disappointed that we didn't get to use her. But so I do try to use her when we can. So when we retake Trista, it feels like it's a little bit of a letdown, because like everyone's gone and you're kind of anticipating a big fight. Although we do get to fight Patrick, and I really like this part, because we really get to see Patrick like change and grow, and I like, it's not like he was some like, oh, I despise Patrick, he's the scum of the earth, he's the worst character. But he was definitely, you know, someone that we weren't made out to particularly like in Cold Steel 1. And so I think it's kind of cool that he gets to, you know, make up a little bit. And I support him and Elise. Reen needs to calm down.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
I agree with that. I agree with that. He needs to let her go. He needs to let her go, Reen.
Just as we get comfy in Trista, we have to go save the Imperial family at the villa, where we fight Altina for, I think, the last time. And here's a question for you guys. Did Altina ever really feel like a true antagonist? Or was it more like when you have to fight, like, a strong archaism? Because, you know, I know that you can say she's kind of robotic, and that's part of her personality, but I feel like Falcom did a good job to make her only really seem as, like, an opponent and not really, like a true antagonist. And so, like, when she joins the team later on in Cold Steel 3, I don't feel like we needed a redemption arc or anything like that.
I feel the same as you, Tyler.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, she's obviously just following orders. She doesn't know anything else. She's just like, I was loaned by my creator to the Noble Alliance, and that's it. I follow my orders, and
she's almost like a blank slate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's kind of pitiful when you think about it as well, because obviously she doesn't know anything else outside of, you know, fulfilling her contract or working for her employer. And I was intrigued by her, even though she didn't get much in Cold Steel 2. I wanted to see more of her, and I'm glad that we did get to see more of her.
I wanted to see more because she had the same last name as Milium. And I guess that was really the first thing that made me want to know a little bit more. But I think that's kind of where I stopped until Cold Steel 3 came along, because obviously you get more of Altina there.
Yeah, actually, a small question. It's the relationship between Milium and Altina. Why does Milium call Clam Solaeus Sammy? Like, I can understand Lammy, sort of, but I can't understand Sammy for Clam Solaeus. How does that translate?
It must be because clammy sounds terrible.
And the S comes from Solaeus, I think. But I don't know how Sammy got into that, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Let's look up the Japanese version.
Because Air Getlem, you got Lem at the end, so kind of Lammy, sort of, I guess. But yeah, Sammy, I just like, where did you get that from? Where did you get that from, William? Is this one of your moments?
So apparently, it's called Kurao Sorasu in Japanese. I don't even know where they got that from, like the Sammy, when they localized it.
So this is kind of where I wanted to cut this episode. We are about to head to the first final dungeon, and the climax of the game.
The final dungeon.
Yeah. Plus Josh is currently dying. He's been doing this whole thing with a migraine. So thanks for sticking through it. And we'll let you have your big crow moment, your bigger crow moment. We did have some already, in the final episode. But where can everyone, TKN, you want to know where people can follow you?
Yep, you guys can follow me on YouTube predominantly. I make YouTube videos that I'm not doing much at the moment because I'm waiting for Hajimari. Thank you, Kitsune, and your team for doing God's work. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook under the same name, The Kaseki Nut.
Adios's work.
Adios's work, yeah, we'll go with that. Yeah, we don't do blasphemy in Zemuria.
And Josh, where will the YouTube stuff be posted once it's up?
Oh, I'm going to make a separate... No, not separate. Well, I'm going to make, like, a channel just for, you know, our podcast episodes. Well, I haven't done that yet, but I will eventually when I finish all rendering all these, like, 20-something episodes. But yeah, it's going to be a lot. You can follow me on Twitter at VanillaPsite, you know, the Pokemon, but I don't tweet that much, not right now at least, because there's a lot of Kiseki Twitter friends that I follow that are going to be playing Hajimari, so I'm trying to avoid spoilers as much as I can, even though I have a lot of words muted already. Can't be too careful.
Yeah, I had to stop following someone last year because they were playing Cold Steel 4 and just posting screenshots constantly, so I don't know what that was about. That was unfortunate. But you can follow me at Trails in the Sky on Tumblr. And thanks for joining us again, TKN. We can wrap this up next time with the big finale episode.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Awesome.